Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and with me today is Liz Martin. How are you doing, Liz?
I'm good. Yeah, everything's going well.
So who are you interviewing today?
Today I am interviewing Associate Professor Lindsay Layton from the University of Alberta in Canada. Lindsay was an old professor of mine in my undergrad. So when I was home a few weeks ago, I met up with him and did an interview.
And where are you now? Are you UK or Canada?
I'm in Bristol. I'm in the UK.
Ah, good. So where have you been and what you've been up to? We've not heard from you for a while.
I've been up to quite a bit. I was in Romania, I guess that was a month and a half ago in Romania, digging up some kind of late Cretaceous fossils. So that was a lot of fun. We were there for 2 weeks, so we found quite a bit, which was fun.
And did you get any pterosaurs?
Yeah, found a couple of pterosaur bits and pieces and some dinosaur, lots of turtle because it's really common. Quite a lot of material this year, actually.
Is there anything new or can you not say?
I can't say too much.
That means that it's something new then, doesn't it?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of new. But no, there's some exciting bits we found, definitely.
Oh, excellent. Look forward to hearing about those.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
And so what are you doing back in Bristol at the minute then?
Not a whole lot at this exact moment. I've been back and forth between Southampton and Bristol just doing general PhD things. But right now, just kind of taking it easy for the weekend. Went to see Jurassic World, you know, all that fun stuff.
And how was it? I've not been to see it yet.
Yeah, I will say this is the same thing that I've said to everyone,
yeah,
which is it's ridiculous and you can take that in whatever way you want.
That's what I've really been worried about. I think that it might just be too ridiculous for me and I don't know. I'm just scared that it's just going to be the worst film in the world. But then I've seen so many people say that it's absolutely brilliant and they're paleontologists as well. So I don't know. I guess I'll have to see it.
It's been pretty split in opinion, I think. A lot of people say that it's absolutely amazing, and other people said it was the worst movie ever. I guess I'm kind of somewhere in between. Paleontologically, it's not great. But as a kind of just sort of entertaining action movie, there's some fun bits. There's also some, like, really? Are you really doing that? kind of bits, but it was fun. I'm going to see it again today, so I guess I can't complain that much.
What, a second time?
Yeah. This is the problem of living in two different cities, two different groups of friends, and they all want to see it, so I'll go again.
Cool.
What about you? What's going on with you?
I am just working on the super secret project of PaleoCasts. Which will all become apparent sooner or later. And then otherwise just getting on with some Eurypterid-y stuff, doing a lot of reading, not anything interesting really. So I don't have any news, I'm sorry everyone.
Nothing new in the Eurypterid world?
There is some new stuff, new species being described and all of that, but they're not published yet, so talk about them. But maybe we should have an episode on that.
Yeah, that sounds like a good episode.
It sounds like an episode I'd enjoy very much. I'm not sure about everyone else. Maybe I could just subject you all to it anyway and just not care because I'm having a great time. But yeah, that should be out in the news, I think. There's should be a press release about all that new stuff. So keep an eye out for Eurypterids, everyone.
Yeah.
So, talking to Lindsay today then, what is it that you guys are talking about?
So, Lindsay is a bit of a kind of different case than traditional paleontologists. He works on a lot of different aspects of invertebrate biology and paleontology, but mostly focusing on using fossils and modern data to understand sort of the current biodiversity crisis and what controls biodiversity. So he's trying to understand how you can use fossils to look at different things like predator and prey relationships and that sort of thing to look at what's happening in the present. So he does a lot of paleontology work, but also going out and looking at modern invertebrates and how they're actually affected by different aspects of their ecology and stuff today. So it's really neat. So we talked about kind of that in general and the work he's done on both fossils and non-fossils and what it says.
Well, it sounds a lot more interesting than us two talking about Jurassic World for another 15 minutes. So yeah, let's just jump straight into the interview. Leave us a comment or a like and share us about, and I hope you enjoy listening.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for joining me today. Can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into this field?
My path was a little bit different, I suspect, from most people who have done these kinds of things, because I actually used to work on Wall Street. And so I spent 5 years working for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And I got to a point where I really wanted to be doing something different. And I decided that I was going to go back to school. And so I wound up, like most academics, sort of going all over the place. I finished my undergraduate degree at Massachusetts, got a master's at Indiana, PhD at Michigan, a couple postdocs. Then I was tenure track faculty at San Diego State for 6 years, I think. And then I had the opportunity to come up here. And UA is a really, really great program, both from the standpoint of being an elite paleo program and an elite geosciences program. So it was a really good professional move for me at that point. And from my perspective, though, one of the things that it's a little story that's off to the side, but one of the things that really sort of got me interested in a lot of the stuff that I do is that while I was working at the Federal Reserve System, I was taking a vacation up at Maine, and I was standing in the Gulf of Maine, which has some pretty big tidal cycles, but you also get these situations where the wave break may be way out to sea by comparison. And so when the tide comes in, the water just goes up, and the tide goes out, the water just goes down. There's not really waves. And so I was standing in the water, and I noticed this large group of these little littoranid gastropods that were just moving across the bottom. And I had no idea where they were going, but I really wanted to know. And I, to be honest, I still don't quite know what they were doing, you know. But it was one of those things where I was really interested in organisms already. And so, you know, sort of for me, it's always been this philosophy of trying to understand life better. And that's really been one of the driving forces in a lot of what I've done. And so, you know, in many ways, I think, you know, all paleontologists wind up being some kind of a split between geology and biology. Mm. And, you know, from my perspective, I'm probably more of an ecologist who happens to work in deep time than maybe some other people might be. So ecological questions have tended to be the things that have sort of driven what I do, and interest in things like predation or why organisms have the shapes they have. Those sorts of things are the sorts of things that have really kind of driven my research career pretty much since I've been in graduate school. So
it's definitely a very different start from most paleontologists. Definitely heard engineers and other kind of sciences, but not Wall Street. That's a new one.
Yeah.
So most of your work deals with questions related to biodiversity. Can you kind of give us a quick overview of what that means and what it is you're trying to understand?
Right. I'm going to paraphrase Stephen Hubble, who's a very prominent ecologist. And Stephen Hubble pointed out the fact that when we're talking about biodiversity, at its most basic form, we're simply talking about the number of different species that are out there, the number of different kinds of things that are alive. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Hubble pointed out some years ago, and I don't remember how much of this was his and how much of this is me paraphrasing it, but he pointed out the fact that we are actually going through this major biodiversity crisis. We are losing species at a truly scary rate. And his point was simply that we have to figure out some way of addressing that in the very near future, because the rate of extinction is scary. You know, there was some estimates by E.O. Wilson some years ago that I think that background extinction rates for the Cenozoic pre-anthropomorphic have generally been about something like 35 species per year. Mm-hmm. And the current estimates are something like, for now, we're losing about 70 species per day.
Jeez.
So it's a shocking statistic. And the thing is that the projections for that are, first of all, the projections are not envisioning that that's slowing down in the near future. Mm. And the other thing is that most of those projections are, they're not looking at any kind of interactions among the organisms. They're basically a projection of, if we eliminate the habitat, the animal goes extinct. Or, of course, if we kill all the individuals of the species, the organism goes extinct. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't even take into account things like, oh, we eliminated the animal's food supply because we over-harvested it. Mm-hmm. And so now this animal's going extinct. Or any other kind of biotic interaction like that that would relate to predation or competition or any kind of facilitation of one organism helping out another one. Say, obviously, they're not doing this in an altruistic fashion.
Yeah.
But something, for example, like coral reefs. Okay, that coral reefs obviously have incredibly high diversity because they create all these little microenvironments. Mm-hmm. Kill all the coral reefs off and you're going to lose all these other species.
Yeah.
So our estimates for these species losses are actually pretty conservative. And it's scary because we're losing animals and plants at a really remarkable rate. And you know, again, this is a little bit of a tangent here. Well, anyway, the point was that Steve Hubble made this comment of, we're in a situation where we have to do something in a hurry, and yet we still actually don't understand the basic things that drive biodiversity. Mm-hmm. Why do some communities have more species than others?
Okay.
And so, to some extent, that's a lot of what I'm interested in. But I should also say that, just kind of in an overview sense, again, this is, I don't want to get too far afield here, but Steve Gould was a very prominent paleontologist, and he was on The Simpsons, people knew who he was. He was probably the most famous paleontologist in the world for a while. And, at some point relatively early in Steve's career, he was very concerned about paleontology sitting at what he described as the high table. And he talked about the fact that physics and chemistry and biology all have, geology all have, they get seats at the high table. Hmm. But paleontology was sort of, the little child that's sitting at the children's table, and, the biologists are saying, oh, how nice, look at what the paleontologist is doing, sort of thing. And so Steve's concern was, he felt that in order for us to get a seat at the high table, that we needed to be examining problems that nobody else could examine. Mm. And I think that's interesting, but I also think that, with all due respect to Steve's memory, I actually think that it was a little misguided given where we are. Mm. And from my perspective, I'm more interested sort of in the connections between some of these fields. Mm-hmm. And I think, it's less a case of, paleontology should be its own field sitting up there with the biologist. Mm. I want the biologist to look at what I do and say, he's a paleontologist, but that's just like an ecologist or an evolutionary biologist or a functional morphologist or physiologist or any of these sorts of things. And that we're contributing somehow to solving what are some of the basic fundamental questions in biology. And so I think, the most basic fundamental question in biology, or at least whole organism biology that's not medically oriented, is, why do we have this many species in a given place or time? And I think that now that we're having a biodiversity crisis, Steve Hubble's right. We have to do something about that.
Yeah.
And so from my perspective, a lot of what I do is really kind of geared toward trying to build these bridges through space and time, the kinds of things that I do, and show that these things are of interest to a modern biologist, show that these are things that might have the potential to help solve some of these kinds of problems.
What kind of organisms and ecosystems are best for these kinds of studies?
Well, of course, I'm biased. You know, it's funny. I probably should throw this out right off at the start that every once in a while when I'm wandering through the woods, I think I should have become a tree ecologist. All right. And that's, but I think that's partly just because I like being out in the forest or whatever. You know, as I work on marine invertebrates.
Okay.
And I work on marine invertebrates, especially shelly faunas, you know, things like gastropods, snails, or clams that are bivalves, these kinds of organisms. In the past, I've worked on brachiopods. And, you know, part of the reason for choosing these groups is that, first, they've got a really good fossil record.
Hmm.
Exceptional compared to most other organisms. It's good in the sense of the preservation's actually good. But it's also good in the sense that there are a lot of them. There are a lot of individuals of these organisms. And, you know, I joke with my students sometimes about, you know, taking them to what I describe as blindfold sites. And blindfold sites are places where I could literally blindfold you and put you on your hands and knees and you'd pick up 1,000 specimens in an hour. All right, just by kind of feeling around. And so, you know, I think if you're going to answer some of these ecological questions, then you really need to have a large enough data set, a large enough amount of material, and you need to be able to go to different places at different times and look at these patterns through time and space, then it's got to be a group of organisms that you can easily get your hands on. And so for the kinds of things I'm doing, I think that this shelled marine invertebrates, like I said, things like mollusks, things like brachiopods, are a really good choice. They tend not to disarticulate easily because they've got shells. They will leave scars and traces of predators that have attacked them. They'll leave evidence of organisms that encrusted them. We can actually get a lot of the ecological interactions. And, you know, as much as I might like the trees in the forest, they're probably not going to preserve as well as these, the brachiopods and mollusks. Mm. Of course, I have to admit, I find them aesthetically pleasing. So,
you know. Well, a mollusk can be somewhat aesthetically pleasing too, but in a slightly different way.
Logarithmic spirals. And, I mean,
So you talked a little bit about like looking at both fossils and modern animals.
Right.
Do you do some of your studies and experiments on modern animals
as
well?
Yes, I do. And I like to keep sort of one foot in the fossil record and one foot in the modern.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I first started out, I don't think I had a real appreciation for some of the modern stuff. And then I started doing some experiments in the modern and some work in the modern. And I think, you know, I'm not trying to give anybody a hard time here, but I think sometimes paleontologists almost lose a little bit of sight of, oh, this is was a live animal.
Yeah.
You know, they're picking it up and they think of it as, oh, it's a fossil.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, if you've done some modern work, it's a lot easier to sort of think about the animal from the perspective of, okay, on a day-to-day basis, it had to get food.
Mm-hmm.
It had to avoid being food.
Yeah.
You know, what are the day-to-day concerns of this animal? And if for nothing else, I think the modern stuff would be great for that. But I also think that in a lot of cases, doing the modern work has been great for sort of setting a baseline or ground truthing, and saying, oh, you know, there are certainly things that we can obviously see and observe in the modern that we can't in the fossil record. I think there's a flip to that that a lot of people don't appreciate, that in some cases, because of the fossil record, we can look over scales of space and time that would just be a photograph in the modern, you know, whereas compared to just having a photograph in the modern. So I think it works both ways. And that's part of when I say I'm trying to build bridges. That's part of what I think we need to focus on. But yeah, you know, doing the modern stuff has been great. And I think, you know, one of the first studies that I did in the modern, which I actually, oddly enough, I've never gotten around to publishing, but I was working with stone crabs, which are these sort of Popeye crabs that they have. They're mostly claw. When you go get crab claws in a restaurant, you're typically getting a stone crab claw.
Okay.
And if you look at these little guys, they might only be, you know, 4 inches wide or something like that on the carapace, but then the claw is about 4 inches. Just have these huge claws. And one of the things I was really fascinated by was I discovered that if you're doing feeding experiments with them and the prey is a little bit too big for them to handle, they actually have individual behaviors for how they will take apart the prey shell. That sometimes, you know, there's sort of an initial attempt that they all try, and if that doesn't work and they realize, oh, the prey item's too big, then they will start playing with it. Mm-hmm. But how they play with it can be very different. And I had one crab, for example, that actually knew how to shuck an oyster. It had figured out that if it chipped away at a certain part of the shell, it could reach in and sever the adductor muscle in the oyster, so the muscle would just spring open. And I never saw another crab do that. But this one had figured out that was a possibility. And so it was interesting to just see that, oh, you know, we tend to look at organisms, I think, as, oh, it's all the species and they're all going to be treated as one thing. It was interesting sort of seeing that, oh, behaviorally, that's not always the case. So just provide some insight that wasn't there otherwise.
Yeah. So what kind of studies have you been doing recently with living things? I think, have you been doing some field work? I think you do a bit of field work.
Right? We've been doing a lot of work the last few years out at the Banfield Marine Station, which is, it's a Western University's consortium property, and UA has been involved in it, I think, pretty much from the beginning. So it's pretty cool. And Banfield's up on the west coast of Vancouver Island. And so it's on the exposed side, kind of away from a lot of the tourists. And I think one thing I should mention that's particularly cool about Banfield is that it's comparatively pristine. Now, for Puget Sound, you can't really ever say that anything is completely pristine at this point. And there's, you know, lots of pollution, et cetera. But there's most of the land around Banfield is actually owned by logging companies. And so there's not really any development. And so you actually can go tens of kilometers, except for the harbor town of Banfield itself. You can actually go tens of kilometers along the coast before you hit some other kind of human settlement. And so it's a relatively exposed area. And I had done work at some of the other marine labs on the coast, the west coast of North America, in places like in California or the Friday Harbor Labs in San Juan Archipelago, which isn't even that far away from Banfield. And one of the things that really stunned me when I got up to Banfield was the ecosystem just wasn't as damaged. And it wasn't until I saw that I realized, because, oh, you know, you still have these kilometer-long swaths of mussels.
Yeah.
You know, the animals are bigger. There's a greater diversity of organisms. And so it's really been a fantastic place to work. And so we've been doing a lot of work out of Banfield. And one of the things we were really interested in recently was there's been a lot of discussion in the literature about using what are called repair scars to examine predation in the fossil record. And from my perspective, one of the problems with using repair scars is that a repair scar is a failed attack. So you're talking about a case of, you know, something like a crab is coming up to a seashell, like a gastropod or a bivalve, and is trying to break into the shell. And one of the problems with crushing predators is they're a big part of the ecosystem, but, you know, if they're successful, sometimes there isn't much left after they get through pulverizing the shell. And so we regularly use repair scars in the fossil record as an indicator of predation pressure. And the problem, as I said, is that if the shell is repaired, then clearly the predator failed. Well, what does that actually mean from a failed attack standpoint? And so there's kind of been two rival hypotheses to explain what could be going on. And these are not mutually exclusive, but just sort of as end members. One of which is that, well, if you have more attacks, you're also going to have, regardless, as long as the success rate is the same, if you have more attacks, the number of failures will still go up. So you could have the number of failures go up simply because you have more predators or more predators attacking more. All right. You also could have a situation, though, where the prey are evolving better defenses. And if that was the case, you could have the same number of attacks, but the success rate is going down for the predator, and the failure rate goes up then for the predator. And so there's this whole issue of, well, what exactly does a repair scar mean? And so what we want to do is we want to go to a place where we basically knew what the predation pressure was. and then analyze what the repair scars were like on the modern shells that were sitting out there. Actually, I should say the live animals.
Yeah.
So specifically, we're looking at this one species of gastropod that gets regularly preyed upon by crabs. And we looked along this whole environmental gradient. And in very many cases, when you look along some of these environmental gradients from, say, high energy offshore settings to more quiet water near shore settings, unless you really start messing with salinity, as you go to the quiet water settings, the predators are happier. Mm. They don't have to deal with the crashing waves as much, yeah. That sort of thing. They have longer times to go out and actually attack organisms. And we would actually find situations where we would be preparing our setups, and as the tide was coming in, we would see the crabs actually coming in watching. They're sort of waiting for us to get out of the way so they could come feed, you know. So it was pretty cool. So what we did was that we wanted to see, you know, since the crabs are bigger and stronger in the quiet water areas, and also we wanted to see, well, do we see the repair frequencies go up in the quiet water areas, or do they go down in the quiet water areas? And the assumption here would be, if the predators are bigger and stronger, they should be succeeding more, and we'd expect to see the repair frequencies go down in the quiet water areas. Or if they're just attacking more often, then we should see, and the predation pressure is higher in that sense, we should see the attack for the repair frequencies go up. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to look at about 9 different sites along the coastline there. It was actually very cool, because I was doing this as part of, I'm very much sort of into the teacher scholar model, so we were doing this as part of a class, actually.
Oh, wow.
So it was a project built into the class, and Bamfield was great. They actually, because it was a class, they gave us all this money to help do the research. Mm. And so it was a really good use of you know, sort of educational approach to what was going on. And and so the consequence of this is we actually found out that the repair frequencies are going up in the quieter water settings. And we couldn't have asked. The result was so good. It's one of those things where, as a scientist, when you first look at it, if somebody else showed it to you, they'd say, did you fudge your data? Like, this is like a dead on match, pretty much. It was almost a perfect pattern for corroborating that particular hypothesis. And the good part about that too was that there were some people that were sort of questioning, well, can we use repair frequency at all in the fossil record? Is there going to be too much environmental variation? And one of the things that we demonstrated was, well, even when you have a tremendous amount of environmental variation, it's, yeah, predation is going to vary with environment, but this is still picking up that signal. Mm-hmm. And so for us, it was cool for two reasons, one of which was we wanted to be able to demonstrate that, yeah, you really can use your repair frequencies in the fossil record as a means of examining predation in the fossil record, which is cool because we're looking at this ecological interaction. But the other thing was, I want to be able to use these sort of data to suggest to ecologists, you know, a lot of times when you go out and you do predation studies, you do something like a tethering experiment, or you do where you're basically tethering the prey. And so the prey, it's not entirely a natural experiment. Yeah. Or you're doing something like what's called an exclusion experiment, where you actually cage part of the prey system so that the predators can't get to it.
Yeah.
But all these are kind of artificial. They're all very time consuming. They can be very expensive. And if, for example, let's say that I wanted to look at predation frequencies on a given species at a whole bunch of different places up and down the west coast of North America, mm-hmm. or the east coast of North America, and I wanted to compare them, even in the modern. All right. Well, if I have to sit there and do a tethering experiment every one of these places, it's going to be really expensive and time consuming.
Yeah.
If I can use the repair frequency as an estimate of predation pressure, I can go out and probably get 1,000 data points in a few days.
Yeah.
You know, at each place. So I'm hoping to sort of demonstrate that this is something that would be ecologically useful for looking at that kind of a problem. Another advantage from that perspective is that the repair frequencies, the repairs are sitting on the animals for their whole lives once the scar is there. And so I also kind of want to introduce this idea that sometimes, for even in ecology, time averaging, this idea that you're averaging a signal over time can be a good thing, because I don't want to have a situation if I say I'm looking at all these predation pressures up and down the coast of North America. I don't have a situation where, oh, something weird happened in this one spot this year.
Mm.
And so when I look at the tethering experiment, maybe I didn't get any data that year because there was a poor spat fall for crabs or something like that.
Yeah.
So this way, I think we get a much more, it's a longer term signal, but in some cases that's what we want as ecologists. Yeah. So
you mentioned that you can use the repair scars that you see in the modern animals to look at things in the fossil record, but right. What other kind of markings or scars can you look at that we'd actually see in the fossil record?
Right. So the repair scars are a good example of this. We also have predatory drill holes, which admittedly don't seem that far away from a repair scar in some way.
Mm.
But predatory drill holes are, of course, made by, there's certain, most of them are made by gastropods.
Mm-hmm.
So they're made by snails that come up and do the sort of grade B horror movie thing of they grab the prey and they have this kind of thorny tongue called a radula that they use in conjunction with some chemical chelating agents to scrape away a hole in the prey shell. And then they insert the proboscis through the hole and they eat the animal. It's pretty horrific, actually. You know?
That's a little bit terrifying.
Yeah. The nice part about drill holes is that they don't really, and I think this is one of the reasons there's been a tremendous amount of work on predatory drill holes. A lot of people like to work on them because after the hole has been made and the animal is dead, the gastropod doesn't do any further damage to its prey. So the shell's often perfectly preserved. And the other thing that's kind of nice is that if the hole is incomplete, it doesn't bore all the way through, we can actually see that too.
Okay.
So you wind up with a complete system from that perspective of being able to say, we can see the number of successful attacks as well as the number of failed attacks. So that's pretty cool. So drill holes are certainly another thing that we regularly look at. In this lab, we've been doing a lot of work in the last couple of years looking at encrusters.
Mm-hmm.
And so encrusters are organisms that they basically live by physically attaching themselves to another animal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some cases, you know, sometimes this is sort of it's a mutualistic relationship. The host might actually get some sort of value from it.
Yeah.
There are cases that we've seen in the modern where the encruster actually provides some extra defense to a predator. All right. There are other situations where it may only have a neutral effect or it might even be a negative effect. Mm. In fact, probably in most cases, it's a negative effect. But again, we get to look at this sort of direct interaction at that point of being able to see that because we can see the encruster sitting on the hosts. And that can be kind of cool too because sometimes the encrusters do interesting things like they'll be positioned on the host in such a way that they can kind of parasitize the host's feeding current.
Huh.
The host is pumping water and food is coming toward it and the little encruster is stealing the food before it gets there. You know?
What kind of thing does that tell us in the fossil record? Like what sort of inferences can you make about how an encruster is encrusting the animal? What does that tell you in the fossil record?
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, some cases, in the case of the encruster, you actually can, this will sound kind of funny, but one of the main questions was the host alive or dead at the time of encrustation? And in some cases, if you independently tested how the host would normally sit, what its life position would be like, If you can then observe and say, oh, this host is encrusted in a place that it couldn't possibly have been encrusted while it was alive.
Mm.
And then even if you're doing some of the sort of basic paleontology things where you're saying, oh, we want to look at environmental reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if that host has been rolling around for a while on the seafloor, maybe it's not ideal for use as an indicator of a paleo environment at that point. So there's some interesting things you can look at issues of taphonomy, you know, how long has the animal been there, those sorts of things. But of course, you know, as I said, I think one of the things that from my perspective, the cool stuff is always that biological element of what is going on between the host and the encruster. And so one interesting idea that we've been kicking around, although we're still really in the early stages of this, is is there some sort of evolutionary response back and forth, what we refer to as co-evolution, between some hosts and their encrusters? Mm-hmm. Is it, and sometimes that co-evolution can be negative. The host is trying to say, I don't want you to land on me, so I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And the encruster really wants to land there, and so they're doing something else in response. But there may also be other situations where the hosts are doing things deliberately to attract a certain kind of encruster, kind of analogous to what you would see with flowers and bees or something like that, or moths or something like that.
What are some examples of encrusters that you look at? Because they're not really an animal that I think most people would be familiar with.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing here is that I think partly because they're so small, they haven't been as well studied. And I think one disadvantage in that regard is that we often wind up with, you know, enigmatic species, people are not 100% sure what it is. But one of the most common encrusters, which your audience may or may not be so familiar with, are bryozoans.
Okay.
So what our bryozoan literally means moss animal. And they're incredibly common. They're incredibly successful. They all form these little, in the modern, they all form these little colonies. Mm-hmm. Chances are if people in the audience have gone out to the beach and picked up seashells, at some point they have inadvertently picked up a bryozoan colony that's living on these seashells. But they're small enough that we often don't pay attention to them because they just look kind of like this little encrusting mat. They look like moss. And so we tend not to think about them, but they're actually very, very successful, and we find them all over the world and in different oceans, and it's really they're not uncommon by any means, just they're on the small side. But they're also really, really good at competing with other organisms for space. And one of those things is this ability to say, I'm jumping on you, and forming my colony here.
Have you been able to make any kind of inferences from looking at the fossil record to what we're seeing today in terms of the biodiversity crisis?
I would like to say I wish we had moved farther along with this, but it's sort of one of the things that I would say, and this is still kind of in its infancy, but one of the things that I'm a little troubled by is there's some record, and you'll see where I'm going with this in a moment. There's some record, I would say, that there are some predators that, efficiency is the wrong word, but there's a concept that people sometimes refer to as the predation paradox. And the main point here is that if you do an experiment and you take a predator and some population of prey, and you put them together in an enclosed system so that the prey can't get away, really. The prey can't reproduce ever fast enough to keep up with the predator. The predator winds up eating them all out of existence. So the question is, why don't predators just eat things out of existence? And there's all kinds of perfectly reasonable ways for this to be the case. But one of the things that I should point out that's sort of interesting is that if you're a generalist predator and you comfortably prey switch from one prey item to another, you actually tend to benefit the ecosystem.
Yeah.
Because you're to some extent, what you're doing is you're preventing any one species from kind of taking over. Mm-hmm. And we see that in a lot of cases when we remove top predators in the modern, that one of the scary things is that the ecosystem starts to break down. There's this real issue of top-down predation and what kind of effect it has on ecosystems. And I think this is kind of scary because we often view top predators as things that we think of as trophies. They're often heavily hunted, or they're considered good to eat in some cases. And so as we remove these things, we remove the predator's ability to buffer what's going on in the ecosystem. And so we start seeing ecosystem collapses. And I think, you know, we see that in the fossil record. We see that in the modern as well. And, you know, this isn't my work, but there's something which I think is sort of a good example of what I'm talking about in terms of our focus on what's at the top. Jeremy Jackson, who's a fairly prominent paleontologist, has done some really wonderful work also on, I would say, what's gone on for the last 100 years of human history and its interaction with the biosphere. And one of the things he has, which I think is it's brilliant, but it's scary, is he has a set of photographs that are taken from fishing expeditions in Florida. Mm. And he's got these photographs. I think they go all the way back to the 1950s. And the point is, each photograph is supposed to be, you know, the prize winning fish, you know, from year to year. And the first few pictures, you see this, you know, group of smiling fishermen, you know, back in the 1950s. And they all have fish that are, you know, this big, and there's the whole picture is filled with fish in the background that they've caught. And by the time each year, as you go through time, you begin to see that the fish are getting smaller and fewer. Hmm. So that by the time you get to the last picture this decade, you're seeing, you know, the four fishermen with literally four fish.
Yeah.
And the fish are only this big now.
Hmm.
And so, you know, it gets into that whole shifting baseline thing of, we don't realize what it was like maybe even 20 years ago. Yeah. We've sort of forgotten it. We don't have a mental frame for it. And I think, you know, we're starting to see the effects of this on ecosystems. We're starting to see that there are ecosystems that are basically being taken over by what, you know, Jeremy thinks we're going into what he describes as the age of slime. You know, that we're basically going to have all of these things that are fast growing kind of weedy species just sort of taking over the oceans.
Yeah.
Because we're eliminating all the things that eat everything that would keep those weedy species down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think one of the things that's sort of interesting to me about, but scary at the same time about studying predation and the fossil record is that a lot of the lessons we learn in the fossil record could be directly applicable to the modern in the sense of humans as predators. And the thing is that most animal predators do not over-harvest.
No.
And we are very, very bad about that, you know?
Yes.
But there was a study that I've been kind of playing with for a few years that sort of suggests that that predators that are capable, or I should say clades, lineages of predators that are capable of prey switching, that comfortably sort of move from prey to prey as soon as the population of one prey goes down, seem to have lower extinction rates. They have higher survival rates than predators that are more specialized.
Yeah.
And what I think is interesting about that is that, you know, not that we are specialized, but we attack things as if we're specialized because we take so much of it.
Yeah.
We're very, very good at it.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that's telling us something, you know, that, we can collapse a bunch of ecosystems, but this also can come back on us. Because when you think about the number of human beings that live within 50 miles of the coast, 300 miles of the coast, it's the vast majority of the human population lives on coastlines or somewhere not too far away. For a lot of these people, seafood is actually a fundamental part of the diet. If you collapse those ecosystems, you're going to have negative feedbacks for human populations.
Yeah. I can think of lots of examples in the modern world of where that kind of top predator elimination has been a problem, particularly with us doing the killing of them. But what's an example from the fossil record?
You know, to be honest, I'm not really sure that you can point to anything that's on that. Well, you certainly can't point to anything on that level of devastation.
Yeah.
You know, that does it at that extent.
Mm-hmm.
You can point to predators that are over-specialized. I shouldn't say over-specialized. I should never use that word. But they are hyper-specialized for what they're doing. And, you know, of course, when I say, their survivorship rate is lower, obviously we're looking at a lot of data. You can't necessarily point to one individual taxon and say, well, they ate themselves out of existence.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily even suggesting that, but I think, you know, they're losing a certain amount of ecological flexibility as they become increasingly specialized in that sense. And we do see a tendency at a lot of extinction events for the specialists to seem to suffer. Mm. Now, that might be a function of, you know, your environmental conditions have changed in such a way that you're also specialized for that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I never think these things are simple. I always think this is sort of a complex of, you know, your environment's changing. That includes that your prey is changing. And, and can you deal with that sort of thing? And, you know, there's, I can think of some modern predators, for example, that I'm not saying, oh, they're going to go extinct. But I can think of some predators that are far more specialized than near relatives. And so, for example, Chelapid crabs have this, they're interesting. They're also called box crabs. They have this kind of little specialized knob, so to speak, on the chela, the claw. And they actually use this to peel shells. And the impression I've gotten is that so when they're peeling, they literally will grab the gastropod and they'll sort of hook this little thing into the aperture and they basically kind of go around the gastropod, almost like you're peeling a potato. All right. And peeling kind of normally works that way with other crabs, but other crabs aren't so specialized for doing this because they don't have this little specialized apparatus. But the thing is that because of that sort of peeling strategy, they're far more focused on being able to take certain kinds of gastropod prey. You know, they've got to be able to get the chela into the right position, so the apertures to be the right size. They don't handle bivalves as well. They seem to be going down this kind of path of specialization. So that's, as I said, it's really kind of preliminary stuff. We're looking at clades that seem to be more specialized versus clades that are a bit more generalist, just to see what happens to them in extinction events. And so far, our preliminary results would suggest that, oh, the specialists are actually the ones more likely to be suffering. Which is kind of ironic because during probably normal background times, they're the ones that might actually be more successful. But again, maybe that's a lesson for humans.
I was just thinking about kind of the time scales that you're looking at with this kind of stuff. Because with the modern animals, of course, you're looking at it over a quite small time scale.
Very short,
But then typically in the fossil record, especially with, you know, what I'm looking at with vertebrate paleontology, you're looking at millions of years. Are you able to look at it in a kind of shorter time scale in the fossil record?
This is one of the things, and when I talk about this from a bridge building standpoint, you know, one of the things that I think is a big problem is that when we look in the fossil record, you know, even when you're talking about, you know, event beds, you know, you sometimes get situations where you have beds that are deposited over very, very short time periods, you know, maybe even like a few days or something, and you kind of catch the animals in the act, so to speak. But those are still going to be few and far between. Normally what you're looking at is you're basically saying this is an average system. You know, we're picking up this ecological signal and it's clearly coming from thousands of generations potentially of organisms. And of course, that's a real concern for a lot of people because, you know, as you said, you know, you're comparing this with maybe one generation in the modern. Or maybe not even one generation, like I said before. Could be 1 year. All right. And it gets at, you know, some years ago, I've heard a number of people comment on the fact that, well, one of the problems with sort of looking at paleo versus ecology is that we have a real hard time getting at the in-between time scales, which is probably the scale at which evolution is happening, you know, from a temporal standpoint. But one of the things that we've sort of modeled this as sort of interesting results is that I think people kind of look at taphonomy. They look at, you know, the things that make it difficult for us in the fossil record, the things that would cause the animals to be lost to the fossil record or for the signal to be mixed. I don't think people realize that taphonomy, I think this sort of people go in, they have this attitude of, well, taphonomy can do whatever it wants, so the signal we can see in the fossil record could be produced purely taphonomically. And the reality is that taphonomy is very much a randomizing process. And that's important because if we do see something that looks like an ecological signal, like a predation signal, or something like that, when we're looking at a lot of predation data or if we're looking at some other biotic interaction. For that signal to have survived, it had to have been very strong and persistent to overcome the taphonomy that would have produced it. And so, you know, on the one hand, okay, when I pick up a shell and it has a repair scar on it, well, I know that that repair scar, even though it might be 400 million years old, it actually happened in the space of a couple of minutes. All right. But then when I say, well, I'm looking at a whole bunch of organisms from the same bedding plane, mm-hmm. maybe I'm not talking about just a few minutes anymore. I'm talking about years and years and years and maybe thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as I said, if that interaction is so strong and so temporally persistent that it still gives us a statistically significant pattern that we can say, hey, this is different from what we saw over here or at this time. To me, that's meaningful because you can't create those sorts of trends taphonomically.
Yeah. Can you give a quick sort of definition of taphonomy in case people
are sure
of what that is?
I think an easy way to describe taphonomy is, sorry, I keep throwing that term out. An easy way to describe taphonomy is it's everything that happens to the organism after it dies up until the point that we find it as a fossil. All right. So you could be talking about all kinds of things. You could be talking about somebody coming over and scavenging the fossil or scavenging the organism after it died or it chemically dissolves. It gets buried. It gets compacted. It could be damaged. It could be. But then it's going to sit in the ground and it's got to actually go through the fossilization process. And then it could still get dissolved away by groundwater. Mm. And it could even, I suppose, technically, you know, if it gets run over by a bulldozer in the modern, it's still part of the taphonomic process, you know. And I think in a lot of cases because we look at taphonomy, we look at these processes and we think of this as damaging. We tend to view taphonomy as our enemy, all right? Yeah. But in many cases, as I said, you know, sometimes when you look at things where you say, oh, time averaging is a kind of taphonomy. Time averaging is when you're basically saying events from different times are being averaged together in such a way that they appear as if they're coming from the same time. So if I look at a single bed, there's obviously some time averaging going on in the bed. But I think, you know, as I was talking about, even in the modern, I think sometimes there's advantages to time averaging because it takes out the noise. It takes out the unusual years where something that was abnormal happened, you know. So I think in some cases, the fact that it produces this averaging signal is actually a real powerful advantage to taphonomy. And in some ways, you know, I'd like for modern ecologists to actually even be a little bit more aware of that in the sense of, oh, I can run out here and I can get these data from 1 year. But if I had easy ways of getting data from 10 years, that actually might be more impactful in terms of understanding what's going on with that particular ecosystem.
Yeah. It's funny because I think I just figured out where I got my definition of taphonomy because it must have been
in my 414 class.
Because that is exactly what I always say when somebody says, what's taphonomy? I say everything that happened from the time it died to when it's found as a fossil.
But I think it's probably for me, but I'm not sure where I got it from, but it's a very intuitive way of, I think, thinking about it.
As soon as you said it, I went, hey, wait a minute.
That sounds familiar.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
Huh, that's funny. So now kind of coming full circle where we started talking about modern animals, how does the research you've done relate to kind of the modern biodiversity crisis and what have you kind of been able to find about sort of the future?
We're still, I wish I had more.
Yeah.
We're still kind of at the beginning of this sort of research. I think one of the things that's been sort of challenging is we've had to do some of, for want of a better term, basic research in the sense of, oh, we can demonstrate that repair frequencies are telling us this and not this. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that groundwork had to be done in the first place. But one of the things, there's a couple of things that I'm really interested in right now, and I'm hoping to be able to use these sorts of information that we've already learned and apply this. One of the things that I think is sort of an interesting system that's going on, but again, it's sort of, a lot of times, unfortunately, when I say interesting now in the modern, you could also add the word tragic, all right? If you look at Pacific Coast marine invertebrate systems and what's going on in, say, the Rocky Intertidal or the upper parts of the shallow intertidal, I think we're obviously seeing increasing environmental change and we're seeing increasing problems with the ecosystem. And some of that might be, you know, directly attributable to things like global warming and shell acidification or just the pollution we're putting in. Mm. One of the things that I'm always concerned about with you know, by no means am I, do I want to give the impression that I don't think that global climate change is a problem, because it is. But I think sometimes humans are prone to almost using as an excuse for what's happening. And they might be ignoring sort of the more direct thing, like over-harvesting. All right, in some cases. And so, for example, you know, I do a lot of these works on these crab molluscan systems. And when you look at crabs, all right, so if you go on the Pacific coast of North America, two of the more common crabs are the Dungeness crab, which everybody likes to eat, and Red Rock crabs. All right, and both of them are predatory. They're both shell crushers. They both like to come up and, you know, crush things and, you know, other crush mollusks and eat them. But one of the interesting things is, if you went 20 years ago and you were pulling up crab traps, crab fishermen would have just taken the Red Rocks and thrown them back.
Yeah.
And Red Rocks are very common predators in our rocky intertidal systems, and they're a main source of, I think, a certain amount of top-down control in the ecosystem, in the sense that, you know, they're basically moderating some of what's going on in the ecosystem. And what's happened is that the Dungeness crabs have been so badly over-harvested that there's this huge increase in Red Rock crab takes. Like, basically what's happened is that, you know, people have gotten to that point. It's like, well, we used to throw the Red Rocks back because the perception was they don't taste good. But now the Dungeness crabs are so few and far between, and if you throw them in a pot, well, most people aren't going to be able to tell anyway. All right. And so, you know, when we were doing some crab census work, I was a little troubled by how few Dungeness crabs we actually pulled up. A lot of people have their crab traps out there, and the crab traps are just pulling up Red Rocks. And the harvesting of Red Rocks in California has increased exponentially over the last decade or so. And it's kind of moving up the coast.
Yeah.
So it hasn't really gotten up to Washington or British Columbia yet to the same extent. Yet I already think we're depleting the Dungeness populations enough. So the question here, one of the things I'm really interested in is, if you remove the Red Rocks from the system, what are you going to do to these rocky intertidal habits? You know, are we going to have a situation where we're actually going to start getting some kind of an ecosystem collapse? And, you know, I think we tend not to think of some of these marine invertebrates as being important, because we just think, oh, they're invertebrates, or there's a lot of them. You know, I think there's been some interest, for example, in, you know, we've done so many things to the otter population. And I think people are a lot more aware of that because, you know, we came close to hunting them to extinction. But now we're putting them in places, and there's this sort of controversial situation up on the coast of British Columbia where they reintroduced the otter into a First Nations area. And for reasons that we don't fully understand, the orcas in the area are not recognizing the otters as prey. And so the otter population has gone berserk.
Interesting.
And they are wiping out the mollusk population in this one little area, which is also causing, you know, things like seaweed proliferation, because nothing's grazing down the seaweed. And so I think we could be looking at the same kinds of things with the crab populations, but nobody really wants to talk about it, you know. And so that's something else that I'm very interested in examining is okay, I'm interested in these trophic webs. I'm interested in this kind of top-down control. And if we're using something like the repair scars to actually be able to say, okay, let's get an estimate of what's going on with the predation pressure, how does this change as the crab populations change? And then in turn, you know, we've also been collecting a lot of community data. Will this actually affect the communities? And so, you know, it's one of these, I hate to say it, but it's one of those studies that on the one hand I'm kind of fascinated by, but on the other hand, I wish I didn't have to do it. So
just kind of to wrap up, is that what you think is next for your sort of research, looking at those?
We're the other thing that's a major component of it. You know, one of the other things that I'm just kind of generally interested in is, and this is maybe a more direct answer to your earlier question, is, you know, I was talking about, well, what, we don't have a clear-cut idea of what controls things like biodiversity. And one of the things I really do want to understand is, I want to get a better handle on how predation affects biodiversity. And, excuse me, We have a lot of interesting hypotheses out there. A lot of them have been well corroborated in terms of the relationship between predators and diversity. And already mentioned, there's this idea that predators may in fact enhance diversity because you're in a situation where they're depressing the populations of an otherwise dominant competitor. But I think we need more work on that sort of thing. And I'm trying to do it kind of parallel modern and in the past as well. And in particular, one of the things we've been kind of playing with is, do you generally just get more even communities? You know, more what we think of as a kind of a stable, healthy community with kind of relatively, you know, not just one species dominating it, but many species sort of near the top. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean like the top of the food web, but for any given trophic level, you would have a fairly high diversity of organisms, and are predators enhancing that? And, you know, there's been some really interesting work that's been done with some of these things, for example, with wolves in places like Yellowstone.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I think there certainly could be more work done on this with marine systems and with marine invertebrate systems. And I want to be able to try to do this both in the fossil record and the modern. So we've got a couple of talks out there, but no papers directly on that yet. So
that's really interesting. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Lindsay.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do it.
I think Lindsay really raises quite a few good points. I think that I myself am very guilty of just kind of lumping all species together, saying like, well, with my Eurypterids, this is this species, it does this. This is this species, it does that. And then just having each and every one just a complete clone of each other. But what you were saying with the crabs, so it's even related to what I do, they're all arthropods, and how the crabs all had different predation techniques, and how that one individual was able to work out how to open those mollusks. I really should think more about the individual animals than the species themselves, I think. So yeah, important points.
I think you definitely kind of hit it home with how you can use modern animals to understand and a lot of the assumptions we make in fossils, like this species only does this and this is exactly what you expect it to do, and then you look at modern animals and realize that that's not really how it works. So why would it have been that way in the fossil record? It just doesn't quite make sense. So I think he's definitely kind of hit the nail on the head with a lot of important assumptions we make in the fossil record.
But then also, wouldn't you have to kind of average? We're talking about a species that'd be around for at least thousands of years. So can you really take into consideration the ecology of an individual opposed to the species?
I guess it's just important to recognize that it's not sort of the law. Like, if you think that most of them typically did this behavior, that doesn't mean that all of them only did that all the time, and recognize that there's other possibilities as well.
And it's also scary, the kind of effect he was talking about when you remove the top predator and the collapse of ecosystems. I've never really considered that it might just throw everything out of whack, and then you suddenly start threatening everything in the ecosystem.
Yeah, you see that quite a lot with, I know in Canada they talk about getting rid of the wolves in order to bring up the caribou population, but then all of the ecologists go, no, no, you can't do that. If you get rid of the wolves, you will completely destroy the whole system. And it's really important to recognize what happens when we kind of get our hands in that.
Yeah, as a geologist and not a biologist, strictly, that was something new for me and a new way of thinking about things. So it's worrying.
Yeah. Definitely.
This is the first episode that I've come out of very, very worried.
Yeah.
Oh, well, next episode, hopefully, will be about giant Eurypterids, and then everyone will be happy.
Yay!
But that's just my ideal episode. If you have one that you'd want to hear yourself, please let us know in either the comments for this episode or just send us a message, and we'll see what we can do. But until next time, see you later.
See you. We'll be right back.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.